Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This piece was brought to you by Whole Foods Market, wholefoodsmarket.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg, and Carmen DeVito is at the beach. Lucky her, basking in the sun. So it's me solo as the host, but we have a really, really special show today. And we have guests in the studio, Lenore Rice from Seabird and Rice, fine Italian terracotta, and Abby Zabar, artist. So we bring the culture to horticulture, and today we're going to talk about planters for the garden. Very, very, very special planters. But as you know, we first have to put this in context. So we're going to do a bit of background on the planter in general and our horticultural honor roll of the week. So the flower pot is kind of a lowly item that looks to the past and to the future. Its origins date from about 10,000 years ago, ancient Chinese, Egyptian, Mesopotamian, Greek, and Etruscan pasts. Its future lies in reproductions. So, in thinking about how the terracotta pot got to the colonial United States, it seems natural that the 18th century botanists would have used terracotta to transport plant specimens, among other methods, back and forth to Europe. As found in John Bartram's garden, shards of terracotta have been unearthed, and we can only imagine what gems and discoveries they carried. But let's also note that the earliest pot found in the colonial United States dates from the 1590s and was actually thought to have been brought here via the Spanish. That's found in South Carolina on Paris Island. So our horticultural honoree of the week goes to a woman that is illustrating and illuminating the history of the flower pot, Susan Tamlevich, a garden historian and curator of an exhibit called A Place to Take Root, a flower pot history exhibit at the United States Botanical Garden in Washington, D.C., and this is an exhibit from 2005. So welcome, Lenore and Abby, and I want to read your bios a little bit and a little bit of history about Seabird and Rice. Lenore, you were a very corporate lady. Lenore's background, you're one of the founders of Seabird and Rice, fine Italian terracotta, the leading U.S. importer of handmade terracotta planters and urns from Impruneta, Italy. Seabird and Rice pots can be found in private and public gardens all over the country, including the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, the New York Botanic Garden, the Biltmore Estate, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Lenore was born and raised in Brooklyn. She came to the garden ornament business by a circuitous route. She began her professional life as a tax attorney and lawyer, first for the U.S. Department of Justice, and then for the New York law firm of Sherman and Sterling. But she's always had a passion for Italy and for things Italian, and she founded Seabird and Rice with Mara Seabird in 1994. And a little bit about Seabird and Rice, a little history. Siebert and Rice is the leading U.S. importer of handmade terracotta planters and urns from Impruneta, Italy. It was founded in 94, and the two former Wall Street professionals left their careers to pursue more creative alternatives. So a little history. 20 years ago, Mara and Lenore started the company, Impruneta, and its magnificent frost-proof terracotta were virtually unknown in the United States. Though Impruneta terracotta has been popular during the Gilded Age and adorned the important estates of that era, after the wars it disappeared to be replaced by machine-made products. Siebert and Rice reintroduced Impruneta terracotta to this country with its inaugural collection in 1994 and won Best in Show at the 1995 New York Flower Show. In 1998, it made its mark when it launched its unprecedented American collection of pots designed by American designers and made in Impruneta by Italian artisans with Italian clay. Designers for the American collection include Guy Wolfe, Bunny Williams, Charlotte Moss, and Abby Zabar, among others. Today, Siebert and Rice pots grace the most beautiful homes and institutions around America, including the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Biltmore, the New York Botanical Garden, and Longwood Gardens. About Siebert and Rice terracotta, Impruneta is the center for the production of terracotta since the time of the Etruscans and is well known as a source of the highest quality terracotta in the world. Siebert and Rice has selected the best workshops in Impruneta with the most talented artisans to make their pots. Each pot is made completely by hand. Siebert and Rice terracotta is distinguished by three distinct characteristics: its unique pink color, its exquisite detail, and its durability. The unique chemical composition of the Impruneta clay, which is high in iron and other chemicals, combined with high firing temperatures and long firing times, makes this the most durable terracotta in the world and the only truly frost-proof terracotta. With proper drainage, these pots can be left outdoors, planted year-round, even in cold climates. So now Abby Zabar, who's one of the artists. Abby and I know each other from long, long, long days ago when I was at the Hort Society, and Abby had an exhibit of her drawings of the flowers of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the drawings that are in the main entryway. So she is an artist, author, and designer of five books, garden-related. Her first book is The Potted Herb, winner of the GWA Award for Best Gardening Book in 1988 and is now considered a gardening classic. She's designed roof gardens in New York and in-ground ones on Nantucket. Some of her gardening and graphic designs have been created for Bette Midler's New York Restoration product, Bergdorf Goodman, Daniel Boulud's restaurant, and the science classrooms of PS198. Alan Stone and Blum Hellman Galleries in New York have represented her landscape collages. She did drawings of the flowers in the Great Hall of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and that was the show that Abby and I were introduced to each other on, and she's also shown at Ursus Books and Prints. She's also in the permanent collection of the Smithsonian, the Jewish Museum, MoMA, Brooklyn Museum, Hunt Institute for Botanical Documentation, Cooper Hewitt, Wave Hill, Parrish Art Museum, International Paper Corporation, and Mead Paper Corporation of America, as well as the Louvre, the Institute of Contemporary Art in London, and the Vilan Museum in Oslo. So, she's illustrated articles that have appeared in Garden Design, Horticulture, Fine Gardening, Gourmet, and the New York Times, in addition to Hortus, the Royal Hort Society, The Garden publication, Gardens Illustrated, and Topiaris in the UK, A Vine in the Sky. She's received the 2010 award for Best Newspaper Writing from the Garden Writers of America. In 2014, she was honored with the NARGS Carlton R. Worth Award, given to an author of distinguished writings about rock gardening and rock garden plants. She is the program chairperson for the Manhattan chapter of the North American Rock Garden Society, as well as learning leader at PS198 in New York. So that was a mouthful. You ladies have done extraordinary things. Thank you. So Lenore, Siebert and Rice pots are amazing.
Thank you.
Tell us how you went from corporate law accountant to garden supplier.
Well, I had left the practice of law when my children were born to get a little space. And I was ready to do something, get back to work, when a friend invited my family and Maura Sieber's family to share in a villa in Tuscany, not far from the town of Impruneta.
That's a good friend.
Yeah.
Everyone needs that friend.
Yeah. So I had read about the area, and I read about Impruneta. And one day when we were there, I said, anyone want to take a ride to Impruneta and look at terracotta pots? And Maura Sieber said, I'll go. So the two of us drove over there. We fell in love with the pots. We wanted to buy some for ourselves. And at first, they didn't want to sell it to us. They just thought, like, oh, it's too much trouble to ship back. And
right.
So when they said no, of course, we had to have it. It became a burning passion. So we managed to buy some pots for ourselves. We arranged the shipping. We had it sent back. And when it arrived here, we looked at it and we said, this is more beautiful than we remember.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing like it in this country at the time.
Right.
So we said, well, maybe there's a business here. So we had the pots photographed. We put together a little brochure. We took them around in the car, and the rest is history.
Right. So are you a gardener, or were you a gardener?
I am a gardener now. I came to gardening from being a pot importer.
Okay. Okay. And tell us tell us a little bit about Impruneta. Like, tell us a little bit about the terracotta industry.
So Impruneta is a little town in Tuscany. It's about 20 kilometers south of Florence. And it has been a center for terracotta production since the time of the Etruscans.
Okay.
And it's because of the unique qualities of the clay in this area. So it's interesting because Impruneta is very close to the Chianti region, but it's just far enough so that the soil changes, so that in Impruneta they have great pots but not such great wine. In Chianti they have great wine but not such great pots. And so they've always produced terracotta here, and during the Renaissance a lot of the great Renaissance artists worked here, including the Della Robbias, and the roof tiles on the Duomo in Florence are from Impruneta and have always been.
Okay. So how did you got these pots back into New Jersey, and then how did you just call the guy up and you said, hey, I want to start an import business with your pots?
Well, so we went back.
Okay.
So this was in 1994, and there was, you know, no email.
Right, right.
And even phone calls were difficult. So
they're still difficult.
They're still difficult. Yeah. Yes. So we went back and we said, okay, this is what we want to do. And they said, okay.
Okay. So they were not previously selling to the United States.
Correct.
Okay. So how did you start the company? You said you made a little brochure, but so you just put it out there, right?
Yeah, we did. I mean, well, you know, I had a law background and Maura had a banking and business background. Mm-hmm. So we formed a little corporation and we trademarked things and we put together the brochure and, you know, we took out advertisements in magazines. In those days, there were a lot of print magazines.
Right.
And then when we showed the pots at the New York Flower Show, and they won Best in Show there, then everything kind of took off.
Right. So what are some of the challenges you have faced with the importing company?
Well, the biggest challenge was shipping within the United States.
Right.
I mean, we'd get the pots here from Italy in great condition, and then we'd ship to St. Louis, and they'd be smashed. So I'd say our biggest challenge was to work with the packing company to come up with a system that we could package these things to ship them.
Right.
You know.
Right. Across.
Within the country.
Right. Right.
Lenore, can I just interrupt for a minute? Why was the challenge once it got here? Wouldn't you ship it in the same carton?
No, they come from Italy stacked with straw on pallets. And then we break down the pallets and we may sell one pot at a time. So.
Right. So you are selling all across the United States now?
Yes.
Okay. And how many are you selling? You sell direct to consumers, but then you also sell wholesale to garden centers, right?
Right. So we're both retail and wholesale.
Okay.
We do a lot of trade shows to the trade, and we sell to landscape architects and landscape designers who place the pots in gardens.
Right, right. So where was the first, after New York Flower Show was the first kind of coming out, and then you placed orders with New York Botanic Garden, or that gave you a lot of visibility. Yeah. So who was your next
I think one of our biggest breakthroughs was the Biltmore Estate in Asheville. And they had contacted us. Again, this was before email and digital photography. They had contacted us and said they had some terracotta pots that were placed at the estate when it was built in the 1800s by Olmsted.
Yeah.
And some of the pots had deteriorated after being out in the Smoky Mountains for 100 years, and they were looking to replace them.
Okay.
So we said, okay, well, send us, you know, photographs, and if there are any markings on the pots, send us, you know, the photos of the stamps, the markings. So we got all these photos from them. We then sent them to Italy.
Uh-huh.
And this was one time we did get a phone call from one of our workshops there, so excited, because not only did they recognize the pots, which had been made by one of the great artisans of the 1800s, but their grandfather had bought the original molds when that workshop closed.
Oh, so how lovely.
It's incredible. So the pots are made by hand, but the ornamentation is made of molds, the masks and the rosettes and the garlands. And so we wound up making essentially new, you know, originals for Biltmore Estate.
Using the same molds, right?
Using the same molds.
That's cool.
And so that was also, you know, that got us a lot of attention on both sides of the Atlantic.
Right, right.
And
so tell us a little bit about the handmade process. Now, I was lucky enough to watch the video on your website about the manufacturing process. So tell us a little bit about that. Those hands.
So it's a really difficult process because the clay in Impruneta is a very dense, heavy, strong clay.
Mm-hmm.
So they take the clay and they start with the soil. They just dig up the soil and they pulverize it and they take out the stones and they, you know, thin it out.
Right.
And then they mix it with water in like a big mixer, which is like a dough, you know, like mixing dough. And that's the only machine in the whole process is the machine that mixes the clay.
Okay.
And then they knead it and roll it out just like bread dough. And they make these long rolls of clay.
Mm-hmm.
And then they walk around in a circle and they build up the pot going, like instead of like a wheel where the wheel spins around, the pot stays stationary and the potter goes around and around in a circle, building up the pot a few inches at a time.
Right. And tell us about how long it takes. I mean, obviously pots are different sizes, but like a big pot, you know, like a 24-inch high by, you know, by 22.
So a big pot, they can only do like about 4 inches a day because when the clay is wet, it collapses if they try to make it too big. So they do about 4 inches, let it dry a little bit. The next day they do another 4 inches.
Right.
And so, you know, a large pot probably takes about a week to make.
Right. Do you get many custom orders?
We do.
From the United States?
Yeah, we do. Now, a lot of people have, you know, special sizes they need or special designs. We also do a lot of historic reproductions for historic gardens.
Okay, so tell us a little bit, this is a good segue, to the American collection that really like launched you guys, right? Tell us a little bit about those designers that you are working with.
So the first designer we worked with for the American collection was Ryan Gainey in Atlanta. And Mar and I were in Atlanta, and we went to meet him. We wanted to see his shop and his garden. And he had these drawings he had done of these two pots that he was interested in having us make. And we had it hadn't crossed our mind before that. But the drawings were just so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So we took them to Italy and had the pots made, and they were just gorgeous and incredible. And then after that, Guy Wolf approached us because he, of course, is a potter, but he can't make big pots. He's limited to the size. So he thought, well, you know, maybe we can make these designs in bigger sizes in Impruneta. And so those were our first two designers. And then after that, it just became very exciting working with people like Abby, who are just so creative and beautiful and come up with designs that are really American, you know, and work so well in American homes and gardens, but yet have the workmanship of the Italians.
Okay. Now, workmanship, Abby Zabar, we have to talk to you about workmanship because that's all about your craft. I've known Abby for decades now, and when I first saw her drawings of the flower display at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, they are the most loosely detailed, and I know that's two opposite ends of the spectrum, but they are the most exquisite drawings, and they still are in my mind, and they will never leave my mind. So you are all about attention to detail. So how did you just designed this orchid pot. Tell us the impetus for the orchid pot.
Thank you, Alice. Well, I collect pots because I am a container gardener, and I actually believe that the container is as important as the plant that goes into it. And I've always been intrigued by a pot that looks like it's there for a special reason. The Victorians also always liked to do pots that were for special reasons. So I began collecting these holy pots, holy terracotta pots, that turned out to be for orchids. And they became more and more fascinating, to the point of I would see marks on them. Some would have like a seal on them from royal palaces. And in my friendship and in having worked with Siebert and Rice before, I proposed to them the idea of doing a contemporary orchid pot. And the way that I communicate all of my designs, whether it's a pot, whether it's a piece of interior design, is through drawing. It's very easy for me to draw something. And I feel extremely lucky that on the other end, these artisans in Italy were extremely responsive to what I was drawing, to the point of, I mean, one of the most charming things is the first pot that I did for Siebert and Rice was called this critter pot, and it's a long, long tom pot, mm-hmm. and that was based on, I wanted a long tom pot that could be the maximum height that could go into a standard UPS shipping carton.
Excellent.
Yeah, right. That was without extra charge.
Right.
So I put a rim of bugs going around the top and then a rim of other critters going around the bottom. And that's why it's called the critter pot. Mm-hmm. And I sent, with the drawing of the pot, I sent a bunch of critters, drawings of like worms, of butterflies, of like dragonflies. And I just said to the artisan there, take it, it's yours,
uh-huh.
and put the bugs on the pot.
Uh-huh.
And he was so charming because he just thought, well, I'm going to put the flying bugs on the top and put the crawlers on the bottom.
Of course. Yeah.
And I thought that was so charming. And
right.
I felt instantly, yes, he's in touch. We know what we're
yeah.
talking about.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful to work. I mean, I am a detailist, and it's wonderful to have a responsive person on the other end, you know, say, I see the picture rather than, oh no, she's making me crazy.
Right. And this is work rather than art.
Right.
Right. So tell us about the design process. And well, let me first go back to this particular orchid pot. Were you influenced by Joseph Banks at all with this pot?
Alice, I hate to tell you, I wasn't.
Okay.
I'm aware of orchid pots. I don't know which one he did. Are you aware of it?
No. Well, I know that he used similar pots to carry his specimens back and forth. And I know that I think his was taller and a little more cylindrical. Yours seems a little wider.
Yes.
And I know that he had the holes on the sides and mostly on the bottom. So, and that's just from my, you know, Wikipedia Google search. So I was just curious if you modernized his pot or where your, because yours is kind of a wide, right? What's the diameter of that?
It's wide. It's 11 inches.
11 inches.
About 9 something on the interior.
Okay.
But
and the height of it?
About 5 or 5.5. I wanted a very capacious pot. I did not want a stingy little, I mean, for a starter orchid pot, I wanted
right.
it to, for their first orchid pot out in Siebert and Rice's line. I wanted it to be a capacious pot. I did not want it to be, you know, a modest pot.
Right. So. Right. No, it's a beautiful pot. And can I do the ringing?
Sure.
Yeah. I want you to explain when I do the ringing. Explain the necessity of this. We just do one. Okay.
For those who cannot see it, Alice is hitting the pot with a bottle of water.
It's supposed to be wine.
A wine.
and that tone, you know, is how you know it's a high fired pot. I mean,
okay.
And it's a perfect pot. You won't get that ringing on a machine made pot or Mexican pot.
Okay. With that, we have to take a break. Hang on 1 second. You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network.
Break song here is called Kill Me in the Summertime by the Dead Stars. This is Weeding Plants. Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. Today we're talking about pots, and in particular, terracotta pots from Siebert and Rice. We have Lenore Rice with us, one of the owners of the company, and artisan Abby Zabar. So we were, before the break, we were talking about the orchid pot and the beautiful ring that good terracotta makes. Tell us, Abby, a little bit about the design process from sketches to finished product. Tell us how long that took and what that was like.
As I said before, I draw everything that I have a vision in my mind about. And I had sent Lenore and Mara a sketch of an idea of a pot that I had years ago. And time passed. And more recently, we decided again to think about doing a contemporary orchid pot. So I redrew that sketch, maybe with different proportions. I emailed the sketch to them. They then talked about which particular foundry or which particular workshop would best carry this out, and they then emailed my sketch to that person. He then did, I think, the first mock-up of it in clay,
mm-hmm.
and I was blown away because it was like, oh, my God, you know, we're almost... And this was unfired, and even in the gray clay, I thought it looked gorgeous.
Okay.
Yeah. And there was, after that, there was very little tweaking. I mean, we obsessed about the hole size. We obsessed where the marks should go.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, the form was there. These were the details. We were now deciding whether there would be like 1-inch holes or whether there would be 3/4-inch holes, whether there would be 8 going around the belly of the pot or whether there would be closer together.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, we went for it. And I'd say the whole process was as long as giving birth to a baby. It was less than a year. It was
about
9 months. Yeah,
good.
Really.
and probably less painful.
Certainly less painful. I mean, it was divine dealing with Marco. I mean, at one point I said, Lenore, could we have a sense of scale here to make sure we're all on the same track? And I said, just have him put in a pencil next to the pot. And Lenore says, no, he always puts a wine bottle there.
As an Italian should.
Yes.
So where is this pot selling? I know that it's at the New York Botanic Garden for their orchid show. Where else is it selling?
Right now it's at the Shop in the Garden, both at the garden and online.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's shop.garden, shop.m. NYBG.org, yeah. I think. Yeah. And from Siebert and Rice at Siebert-Rice.com.
Okay. And so no one so this just came out. This
it's
is
brand
like,
new. It isn't even up on our website yet.
Oh, I know. I actually looked because I was I was a little nervous about posting the New York Botanic Garden photo today, and I was nervous that I was going to get copyright issues from NYBG. So I took it from your, I think, from your email. So, and where is it going to go next? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, we're hoping it'll be all over the country. Uh-huh. You know, as I said, we're just starting to market it. It's brand new. And, you know, we hope it'll be picked up by some catalogs and some shops and garden centers.
So not only you do more than just pots, too. You do some garden ornaments and you do some benches and stuff. Tell us about the larger product line.
So we do a bench. We do some wall hangings. Mm-hmm. We do some statuary, some mm-hmm. beautiful terracotta statuary, mm-hmm. Some finials and
right.
things like that. We have a beautiful, beautiful fruit basket where each piece of fruit is made by hand separately, and the basket is woven by hand, and then the whole thing is assembled together, and it really is like a piece of artwork.
I loved on the video watching the assemblage of the ornamental pieces, and it's very just, it's almost glued on with more terracotta, right?
Yes.
A very thin layer.
Right, like a slurry of clay almost.
Yeah, yeah. It was a wonderful process.
It's an incredible process, and what's really amazing about this whole thing is that the method of making these pots has not changed, you know, for 500 years. I mean,
right.
They're still doing it exactly the way their great-grandfathers did it.
Right.
And in fact, one of Abby's favorite things when she looks at the video of the pots being made, when they measure the height of the wall of the pot, mm-hmm. they have a bamboo stick with a nail in it.
Uh-huh.
And then they use the nail to kind of cut it off at the right spot. And it's a very old-fashioned, traditional process.
If it works, don't fix it,
exactly.
Right? Yeah, just keep making more. So, Abby, I need you to tell our listeners about your garden because it's so curated and so exquisite. I've been lucky enough to be on your terrace a few times. Tell us a little bit about your garden and about your work with the North American Rock Garden Society.
Well, as I said before, I am a container gardener, and I actually used to apologize about that before because I would think that if you weren't really digging the earth, you were a quasi-gardener. But I actually think that gardens need terracotta pots or any kind of containers besides what is in the garden coming from the earth. And when I was at Highgrove, which is Prince Charles's mm-hmm. estate in the UK, I knew this before I went, I knew he loved having terracotta around. And to me, that was an affirmation of, you know, in really famous gardens, of the importance of having terracotta or pots around. It brings an intimacy that you can't get on any other level. It brings a person-to-person touch to the garden, a very human element to the garden. So whereas I garden on a New York City rooftop, a small, tiny penthouse, nevertheless, I mine it for everything it's worth, I feel. And it has a charm to it that you probably don't get in the big landscape picture. It's filled with tiny vignettes that, you know, are interesting. If you're not interested in that, you walk a little farther and maybe then you come upon the alpine plants. And alpine plants are a natural for rooftops. Mm-hmm. I mean, I live in an alpine zone.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
Especially after these past weeks.
Yeah.
exactly. You know, I have not had pots thaw out yet, and they won't thaw out for weeks. And they take very well to this high altitude and this windy situation that
that we're so blessed with.
Yes, that we are. That you have. It's taking a bad situation and making it good. I mean, you know, plants live in any kind of situation. You can always find a plant in the worst situation. You just have to find that one that's going to work for your worst situation.
Perfect. Exactly. And that's what I love about your garden, Abby, is that, you know, you started off by saying you garden in containers. I think you're a better gardener if you are forced to garden in containers, because you have to be so much more selective about the plants. You don't have the luxury of the space, so you pay more attention to those plants.
Alice, when I go shopping, when I go to a nursery and someone will say, oh, Abby, you said you like that, why aren't you buying it? I'm saying, well, I have to figure out where it's going to go first.
Exactly.
I don't have the luxury of like another plopping 40 acres in.
Exactly. No, you have to be much more selective and judicious about what you're going to use. And that's why the importance of this terracotta and the frost-proof nature, especially considering the winter that we've just had, the fact that you can put a terracotta pot on your terrace and have it survive planted through the freezing and the thawing repeatedly is the most important thing.
I am looking right now, coming out of this winter, the worst that we've had in years, of beautiful terracotta from Impernita, from Siebert and Rice, knock wood, knock terracotta, totally intact, and I am looking at Mexican imitations that are busted in the bottom.
That's right, absolutely. And the fiberglass, chips, it's gross. It cracks, it flakes.
You know what? Even when terracotta, I'm not saying cracks, but when it starts to age in the natural process, after 500 years at least in, you know, Della Robbia terracotta, it's a beautiful kind of aging. It has a patina to it that fiberglass just doesn't have.
No, and that we'll never get.
Yeah.
No.
You know.
It does get a beautiful patina as it ages. It's
Yeah. And then there's those that speed the patina up, which I'm always a little skeptical about. Lenore, we're kind of coming to the end of our show in a few minutes, but tell us what's next for Siebert and Rice.
Well, we are working with a few other designers for some other new additions to the American collection, but I'm not saying yet who it is, but I can say there are going to be some interesting organic shapes and very different from Abby's orchid pots. So we'd like to keep it interesting.
And okay, cool. Have you heard about this blanching rhubarb pot?
No, I haven't, but I'd love to hear about it.
Well, when I was doing a little research, apparently terracotta, if you bury shards with rhubarb, it turns the rhubarb white, and the taste is so much better. There's something from the terracotta. So that's why I was wondering if that was going to be next.
So maybe there's a business for our broken pots.
That's what I was thinking. And then also, like, shallow seedling pots. I could imagine that would be.
I actually have one of those. I have one from England. It's a very thick-walled terracotta pot, and it was for seedlings, heavy as could be. I mean, really, really heavy.
Yeah.
But it had slanted side walls.
Let's see what you can do with that, Abby. Yeah. That would be great.
Right. So, Abby, you are a pot collector as well as a designer. Tell us about some of the pots you've collected and
I'm actually now not collecting pots so much as things that could also serve as planters. Like, I have cobblestones that I have chiseled out that hold my alpine plants. I actually have orchids mounted on interesting pieces of wood. I kind of look at anything and think, that might serve as a pot. Maybe it's a cinder block, maybe a brick that's been broken in a certain way that has a hole in it.
Right. You definitely have the artist eye and the, like I said earlier, the attention to detail for what plants really need. And I think that's what makes your garden so special, is the attention that every single thing is thought about. There's nothing random. There's nothing plopped in haphazardly. It's all exquisitely curated.
Thank you, Alice. Thank you. I feel that the limit of my space makes me hone in on that kind of detail.
And I have to say, I love your book, 55 Friends, which is all about critters. And
yes.
It made me, yes. Yeah. I read that to my son just a couple times a week. He loves it. And it's all the joins
of the worms and the
dragonflies.
Right.
Yeah. Elongated pots for bulbs. How about that, Lenore?
I think a lot of our pots that we do now work well for bulbs. We have some shallow ones. We actually have one we call the ornamental bulb planter. Yeah. And we have a woven basket. And then we have our tom pots, which are great for... Mm-hmm.
Tell us what a tom pot is for our listeners.
It used to be a long tom pot. I don't know how this first came about. But it's a pot that the proportion is longer as opposed to an azalea pot where the height is the same as the diameter.
Okay.
This is longer, and it's usually for plants that had deeper roots.
Okay.
And often, like, they will use them in alpines, they have deeper roots, but they were used a lot to start rose cuttings in Victorian times.
So they're more cylindrical.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And with a shape so that they could drain.
Right. I've seen them in lead.
Yes, but they were in clay.
They were in clay.
Because, yeah, in Victorian greenhouses, everything was in clay.
Right.
You know, and they could fit, you know, they fitted right into each other.
Okay.
And that's why they were on a slant.
Uh-huh.
So you could get them out.
Right, yeah, right. So do you think you've got the, obviously you have the shipping.
We have that figured out, finally.
That's what I was thinking because... when you were talking about containers and then breaking apart pallets and it's
what one more thing
yeah
because Lenore told me this most charming story about what is involved in getting a pot out of Imprenita.
Yeah, great.
You tell.
So well, I was telling Abby that the workshop we do ship the pots here by ocean in a container. And the way a lot of containers are loaded is that they take the container by, you know, with a cab truck, pulls it to the place and load it. But our workshops are in these teeny tiny little winding streets in Italy.
Right.
And they cannot get a 40-foot container up on these streets.
Right.
So they have to take a little truck, load it up, make a couple of trips, take it to their warehouse down at the port, and load the container there. It's really a process getting those pots from these little, you know, old workshops, these 15th century workshops.
I can imagine the buildings are really beautiful.
They're magnificent. Yeah. They're so charming and old and
But what
magical.
I was thinking is, like, every part of this is so primitive.
Yeah.
The 21st century has not at all entered into this. Nothing about it has.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing will. If it will always be made in those locations, that's what you're going to be dealing with.
Right, right. Well, and I think that's what's so special about the pots is the history and the hand, you know? And that just... it doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
And I'm so glad and thankful that you had the foresight back in 1994 to see that and to, you know, obviously it's a business, but it's also, it's more than that. It's really keeping history alive. And
well, thank you.
You know, Biltmore was the first client and obviously you've grown it since then. So it'll be fun to watch.
Well, thanks.
Please give the website so people know where to buy the pots.
So the website is www.siebert-rice.com.
Great.
Thank you.
And Abby, any final thoughts? I can't wait to see what's next on your art boards.
Me too.
So thanks for listening. You've been listening to We Dig Plants. Join us on social media. This show was produced by Alice Marcus Krieg and Carmen DeVito, and thanks to Jack Inslee for engineering. On Facebook, you can join us at Groundworks Inc. We Dig Plants. On Instagram, Groundworks Gardens NYC, and on Twitter, We Dig Plants for weekly prizes. Thanks so much.
Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.